Regardless of where you are in your homesteading journey, whether you are just starting out or you've been at it for a while, there is no way that any of us can know absolutely everything when it comes under the homesteading umbrella. And this is where it is key that you are learning from people who have life experience and have been doing this homesteading when it comes to livestock in the kitchen, but they have been doing it for a long time so that you can bypass the mistakes that they have made along the way. And getting it delivered in your mailbox, in your hands every single month from some of the most trusted voices in homesteading is exactly what you need. And Homestead Living now has Homesteading Monthly, which is an in-print monthly magazine featuring articles from Joel Salatin, myself, Carolyn Thomas, as well as homesteaders who you may not have heard from them, but they have been perfecting their craft and are very much an expert in their area. You can get this for less than $2 an issue. Yes, that is an in-print, jam-packed with articles every single month. Go to homesteadliving.com and grab your subscription right now. Hey, pioneers, welcome to episode number 422. Today's episode, we are going to be talking about mushrooms, both medicinal properties of mushrooms and what mushrooms offer to our diet and our gut health, which of course is tied to our overall health because so much of our immune system, actually our gut to brain pathways of talking, all of those are actually tied to the gut. So super interesting episode. I have a feeling you're going to learn a lot. I certainly learned a lot about mushrooms, but I also want to say that we can learn things from people who may have different views from us, and that is completely okay. But on the same side, I also feel like it's important to talk a little bit about what will be the elephant in the room, perhaps, when you listen to this episode. And this is probably more tailored to my long-term listeners. Thank you so much for those of you who have been hanging out with me and let me know things that you want to learn about on the show. I totally appreciate your feedback. But as a homesteader, and therefore most of you who listen into this are interested in homesteading to some degree, and talking about the subject of eating meat. So I raise grass-fed, grass-finished beef for ourselves, and we sell a very, very small amount to the community. We do not ship. We have, like, we can't even produce enough for the people who want it locally. So this is not any type of business pitch for our meat. We raise our own poultry, and that includes for eggs, that includes for butchering. We also raise our own pork. So there is a difference between regenerative agriculture, truly pasture-raised, not just what is put on a label by large commercial agriculture and their definitions of what pasture-raised is, especially for chickens, my goodness. But I feel like oftentimes when we look at studies, there is so much more to a study and what influences the result of that study, and not always like nefarious means either. But when you're doing studies, for example, when we see studies where people have done like more plant-based versus eating meat, there's so many factors that aren't taken into those studies. One, I highly doubt that the study is being done on meat that is raised with regenerative agriculture practices, that is truly grass-fed and grass-finished, that is raised and harvested on site so the animal is never stressed in a slaughterhouse situation. Because you can't buy that, barely can you buy that at stores. Very few stores actually even carry that type of meat. And then two, if you were to take somebody who is already eating a very, I don't even know what word to put on this type of diet, but it what I would consider a typical homesteader diet, where it is the food that is raised with the highest ethical standards, truly pasture range, free range, eating, you know, as nature intended, grass fed, grass finished when it comes to beef, you know, all of those things, fruits and vegetables that you have largely grown yourself or gotten from a local grower who uses, honestly, usually above organic practices, especially if it's in your own home and on your own land. You take somebody who's eating that type of diet and you put them in a study alongside someone who is eating more of a typical standard American diet with lots of processed foods, et cetera. And you are going to see drastic changes in somebody who went from a typical standard American diet and is maybe eating as the study diet is, right? You're going to see, I would assume anyways, you're really going to see a big difference. Whereas you take someone who's already eating, you know, nutrient dense food, raised in all of the manners that we've discussed, you're not going to see as big of an impact. And so I share that not because I don't think I'm hopeful that that's not purposely what's being done to sway studies, but just there's so many other circumstances that come into play that impact a study's result that isn't always talked about. So it's kind of funny. The more I learn, I feel like the less you can rely at face value on certain things, because there, and then there's individual, you know, our individual makeup. And there have been times where a keto diet, for example, was exactly what worked for me and what I needed in that moment. But I cannot always say a keto diet is absolutely best, because there have been other points in my life where a keto diet was absolutely not the answer for where I was at my personal health journey and what my body needed, what was sensitive, like all of those things. So I felt like I needed to share that preface because Dr. Hobbs was a wonderful information, has a lot that you're going to learn. And I think it's a very valuable episode. I'm excited for you to hear it, but also knowing that I don't come from a place where I think plant-based is the best way to go or the only way to go. But I know if you don't have a quality meat source of the manner that I'm speaking about, then definitely using plants in the way that he's sharing, because it is a more whole-based food way of eating, right? Definitely has benefits. And we all can benefit from the mushrooms, as you're going to hear about in today's episode. I did feel like I needed to just share that with you and kind of have like that open conversation about different studies and different things like that. I think when we get to a place where we cannot discuss things, especially have discussions with people who may have different views with us, I think that that's a really dangerous place for us to get in as a society, quite honest. And so I think it's healthy for us to listen to different things and to also have the discernment to take away from it what we need to, and then grow and move from there. So today's sponsor of today's podcast episode, before we dive into our interview, is American Blossom Linens. So American Blossom Linens is a fabulous American-made sheet company. Not only are the sheets made in the U.S., but they only purchase cotton that is also grown in the U.S. So when we talk about sustainability, and quality, those are things that I look for and companies that I like to support. And when we talk about health, sleep is one of the biggest components, not only what we eat, but sleep is a huge component to our health, making sure that we get enough sleep on a consistent basis, and not just sleep itself, but the quality of our sleep. And having a really good set of sheets that really helps to, and I have no idea how this works, but keeps you cooler in the summer, but keeps you warm in the winter. I used to switch out my sheets in the winter and I would do flannel sheets. They were thicker. And then in the summer, I would switch to obviously thinner material sheets, but I have had my American Blossom linen sheets, the same set, for 2 years now. And I kid you not, I take the sheets off the bed, I wash them, dry them, and then they go right back on. I don't even take the other sheet sets off my closet. In fact, I finally went into my linen closet, you all, and pulled out the sheets that I have not used in 2 years, because I've only been using my American Blossom linen sheets. and donated them to our local thrift store because I simply was not using them. But that is because I get such a good night's sleep on the 100% cotton sheets. They are heirloom quality. Truthfully, other types of sheets that I bought in the past, they weren't maybe the cheapest, but they weren't super expensive. I would say they were like what you would averagely find in most stores. They would wear thin after a year or two. Like by year two, the bottom fitted sheet, it would be where it would be very, very thin, like you could almost see through it. And then eventually like it would end up ripping. And my American Blossom linen sheet set, you can't even see any wear spots. Like they are holding up fabulously. And that's just being used pretty much 365 nights a year for 2 years straight. So they really are great. Highly recommend that you go and check them out. And you can use coupon code PIONEERINGTODAY20. That's PIONEERINGTODAY20 and get 20% off your order at American Blossom Linens. Okay, now let's hop over and dive into today's interview. Well, hello, Dr. Hobbs. We're very excited to have you on a Pioneering Today podcast today. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Much appreciated and glad to be here.
Yeah. Well, I just really want to jump right into it. I've been very excited for this episode and topic. And that is about obviously using mushrooms for nutrition and medicine. So kind of first on that is, how do mushrooms contribute to the nutrition in our diets, basically the health benefits of mushrooms? And are mushrooms really a superfood? Some things tend to get labeled with that. Is there validity to that claim? Would love to have your thoughts there.
Yes. Well, as far as health goes, have the health benefits of mushrooms. First of all, it has to be mentioned that most people in the world, around the world, in most cultures, eat mushrooms almost daily. They're cultivating them. Like if you think about Indonesia, Asia, India, Eastern Europe, Russia, literally most of the world is eating mushrooms frequently, every day. And they don't just eat them for nutrition. They eat them because they know they're healthy as well. So, in some cases, like for instance, in Siberia, people don't have anything to eat in the fall. There might be food scarcity, but then there are mushrooms everywhere because they live in a forest. So they eat the mushrooms because it's a subsistence food. So, and that's rather unusual, but other people like throughout Asia, India, Indonesia, as you can imagine, that's quite a few billion people around the world are literally eating mushrooms every day, cultivating them, getting them from the markets, getting them from the wild. And it's because they have incredible health benefits in a variety of ways. And primarily, they're looking for the nutrition, naturally, the protein and the minerals and fatty acids. I mean, when you look at mushrooms as far as what they offer nutritionally, first of all, I'll just run through it very quickly to summarize what you're getting if you eat, for instance, 3 shiitake mushrooms for dinner. So you add some shiitakes to a stir fry with greens, or you add it to a soup. What you're going to get is like an incredibly high source of super quality protein with all the amino acids. So it really rivals meat as far as the quality of protein that you're getting, literally. And some mushrooms, like the oyster mushroom, is up to 25 or even 30% high quality protein. So literally some mushrooms like shiitake are very high source, oyster mushrooms, very high source of protein and super high quality and very well absorbed too. So literally mushrooms rival meat as far as a really great source of protein in our diet. And as we get older, we need a little bit more protein. The formula supposedly is 1.2 times our body weight in kilograms. That might mean 70 grams, 80 grams of protein. And if we're younger than his 0.8 times. So it might be 50, 60 grams. Now, there's a lot of new research showing that we don't really need as much protein as we're typically getting. New research shows that you can build muscle fine, you can maintain your muscle mass, you have enough protein for body repair, even if you're getting 40 or 50 grams of protein a day. So, and eating too much protein has its problems. So mushrooms really are, and because if, and I recommend that people do this when they're cooking shiitake or oyster mushrooms, put them in a frying pan or a pot and little olive oil, little water, and then kind of steam cook them, steam stir fry them until they're tender. It doesn't take too long with oysters, and shiitake are fairly tender. Maitake is another one. Lion's mane is another one.
So well, that's lion's edible.
Mane. Yeah, lion's mane is good. All those edible mushrooms tenderize pretty quickly. So then once they're tenderized, which only takes about 5-10 minutes, then let when the water goes off, they'll start browning a little bit. So just stir them a little bit and let them brown just a little bit. And then you get this umami flavor, which is so nice. And so then and mushroom texture, especially shiitake, is a little bit firmer. Mushroom texture is a little bit like, reminds one of meat a little bit. So mushrooms, my point being is that mushrooms are a great way to transition from more of a meat diet to a plant-based diet. Now, mushrooms aren't plants really, but they have all the benefits of plants, namely super high prebiotic fiber and all the vitamins and minerals. And so mushrooms are a fantastic way. Adding more mushrooms to the daily diet is a great way to transition and move into a more healthy plant-based diet, which we're seeing so much research out there on. It can extend our life. It can cut our risk of disease and literally in half chronic illnesses like heart disease, diabetes, and so forth. They could cut it in half if we're using mushrooms regularly and we get enough prebiotic fiber. So, and then just to go through the other nutritional benefits of using mushrooms regularly, at least 3 or 4 times a week is what I recommend. And certainly you can eat them every day. You can grow them, you can get kits, you can, of course, buy mushrooms from the market. Hopefully the price is coming down. So what I recommend doing to save money, because shiitakes are kind of expensive, especially organic shiitake, if you're eating them regularly, one way to get around the higher cost, in my co-op, shiitakes are running like $19 a pound. In my local market, they're running about $13 a pound. They're typically not organic. So that's the difference. But, you know, that's pretty expensive. Of course, fortunately, they're pretty light, but still, that gets to be expensive. So what you can do is you can buy like a 1 pound or 2 pound bag of dried shiitake organically grown mushrooms that are seconds. In other words, they're broken and they're not beautiful, but it doesn't matter. So then you just put the shiitakes in a little water, and within 5-10 minutes, they're completely rehydrated. Then you can cut them up and stir fry them. So, and they're much cheaper if you buy them by the pound like that, and you buy seconds. Besides protein, super high quality protein, mushrooms have all the essential fatty acids, linolenic and linoleic acid, and they're not super high in fat, which is good because they're a good diet food. But the fats they do have are high quality and comprise the essential fatty acids that we need. Also, trace minerals. Mushrooms are a very high source of iron and copper and zinc and other trace minerals. So that's fantastic because many people are iron deficient and might be copper or zinc deficient. So mushrooms are great for trace minerals. Mushrooms have a lot of potassium and other major minerals, but they are low in calcium and magnesium. They have some magnesium, but they're pretty low in calcium. So that's why mushrooms are really great cooked with greens. So my favorite dish of all time is just any kind of greens, like even cutting broccoli or broccolini up to small pieces, or if you like kale or you like you know, mustard greens, any type of green, just cut those up and stir fry those with mushrooms, mushrooms and greens, add a little garlic, a little olive oil, and it makes a fantastic dish. And the greens are supplying the calcium and the magnesium. So then you're really getting a complete meal. Just, you can literally eat mushrooms and greens and you would have a complete diet, literally. So of course we like all, there are many other good foods to mix with mushrooms. And I put mushrooms in my soups oftentimes. I make lentil soup very frequently and I add mushrooms to my lentil soup. And we have an instant pot and I really am making lentil soup twice a week and then I freeze it down. So I always have soup on hand that has mushrooms, greens. I put yams in there, sometimes caboca squash or other types of squash, and then carrots and celery and garlic and, you know, and it's just so great to eat it. And literally around the world, lentil soup is a standby of so many millions of people. So that's a great way to use mushrooms, is put them in soups, put them in stir fries, casseroles, however, grilling, boiling, however you want to eat mushrooms. They're going to be delicious and they're going to provide tons of nutrition. And finally, mushrooms have an incredible amount of B vitamins. So in the produce department, mushrooms are the highest source of B vitamins in the produce department. They rival meat again in the amount of niacin, B12, B6, all of the other B vitamins. You're getting a complete source of B vitamins. And then here's another interesting fact. Mushrooms are the only food in the produce department that is high in vitamin D.
Oh, that is interesting. Yeah.
And so all you have to do is buy your shiitake or your oyster mushrooms, put them out in the sun for about 15, 20 minutes, and they will create vitamin D from a fatty acid that is in all of their cell walls, which is called ergosterol. So ergosterol is basically a pro vitamin D vitamin source. And so when you put them out in the sun hits the shiitake mushrooms and converts it to vitamin D. And you can literally, with three or four shiitake mushrooms in your meal, you can actually get your daily requirement of vitamin D. And vitamin D is very important for immunity. And if in the winter, we're not getting enough vitamin D.
Right. Actually, I have a question on that because I live very far north. So I'm in the U.S., but I'm like about an hour south of the Canadian border. So I'm very far north. And living in the Pacific Northwest in the mountains, we have very few full sunny days. So I know for a good portion of the winter, even if I'm outside and have my skin exposed to the sun, it's actually not enough for my body to make the vitamin D from sun exposure. Do you know if that's true of the mushrooms as well when it's far north, or is it a different process? And so even if it's winter sun, it would still be able to do that. I know it's very
still be able to do that.
It would. Okay.
Yeah. It's still, because the other thing with winter, if you were naked and of course you don't want to do that, but if you were to strip down and go out and maybe do a Wim Hof kind of bath or something and stand out there, you know, in the sunshine, even if it's a cloudy day, you would probably get enough vitamin D. Your skin would produce enough vitamin D to get by after about 15, 20 minutes, half hour. But, you know, how many people are going to do that? But because it's winter, we're all bundled up and, you know, we're getting vitamin D out of our hands, maybe, unless we have gloves on. So being that far north, yes, is a risk for vitamin D deficiency, but it's mostly because we're not going to be exposed to the sun. Even if we go outside, we're going to get some in our face, and that's just not enough. So that's why if you're, you know, many people in the winter are vitamin D deficient. It's well known that vitamin D deficiency is one of the primary deficiencies that we have in this country, and especially in the winter, especially if you're dark skinned, especially if you're covering up and you have an inside job, you're not going to be getting enough vitamin D. And even doctors, medical science really promotes the use of supplementation. So you're going to be taking probably 5,000 IUs of vitamin D every day if you're at risk of vitamin D deficiency. And that's going to keep your immune system going.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating. I did not actually know that mushrooms could do that by putting them in the sun. So I'm excited. And this kind of leads to my next question, because so far in our reference, we've talked about all the different ways that you can cook mushrooms, incorporate them into different foods. So do the majority of mushrooms need to be cooked before consuming? Are there any varieties that it's fine to eat raw? Any you shouldn't eat raw? Or is it just kind of more taste preference?
No, they all have to be cooked. Now, because the cell walls of mushrooms contain a polymer, a long chain of glucose molecules called a glucan, they contain two major types of glucans in the cell walls of all mushrooms. And one of them is beta-glucan, which is an immune-modulating substance, and the other one is chitin, C-H-I-T-I-N, chitin. Now, chitin is a polymer that is found in crab shells and crustaceans, so it's very, very tough, as you know. I don't know if you've ever picked up a crab, they're solid. I mean, they're hard. Mushrooms need to have a hard cell wall because they're penetrating wood, they're penetrating the soil. So we cannot digest those, period. So they have to be cooked to make the active compounds available, to make the nutrition available. They must be well cooked. And many mushrooms have to be well cooked, not just cooked. So until they're tender. And if you don't, you can have digestive upset. Like if you ate 3 or 4 shiitake without cooking them, if you ate them raw, your stomach would be very upset because it's just all that fiber. We cannot deal with that. So, and we're not going to get much of the nutritional or medicinal benefit unless they're well cooked. So always cook mushrooms. The one exception is the button mushroom. People put some slices in their salad, fine. Yeah. That's not going to be a problem, but you're not getting much nutrition out of those. Don't count that you're getting any nutrition really out of those mushrooms. They're just for flavor or whatever.
Okay. That's good to know. I know that with some of the wild mushrooms that we forage around here that you can get sick from just what you explained if you don't cook them. But I didn't know if that was true of all varieties of mushrooms because I have seen the buttons where people, you know, I've eaten them raw in salads myself too. So thank you.
Now remember that some mushrooms that you pick in the wild, you know, they all have to be cooked and you could get really sick. There are some toxic mushrooms in the environment, some very toxic ones. In fact, there are a few that are lethal. So always make sure you know exactly what you're picking in the wild.
Yes. No, 100%. We're experienced foragers. So of the mushrooms. But yeah, but it's always good for people to hear
that. That's very important to mention. And in my book, Medicinal Mushrooms, The Essential Guide, I do detail the most poisonous genera and their characteristics. So have you got a copy of my book, hopefully?
I don't yet, but it's on my to-get list, which is why I reached out to have you come on the show because it's on my to-do or my to-get to read. And so I'm like, I would love to have you on to talk about this. Yeah. So traditionally, because I feel like obviously coming from an American background with mushrooms, you know, I know some of our mushrooms that we forage and I use here more for culinary use, honestly, is of course the morels, lion's mane, which I know does have some medicinal properties, chanterelles, like those are kind of the big ones that we forage and eat and love flavor wise. But I know traditionally a lot of mushrooms have been used in many Asian cultures as that medicinal aspect. And so in what way are mushrooms used as medicine? And you said like if you just cook them and consume them, but are there other, you know, mushroom teas or mushroom tinctures, or is it generally just putting it into your food and having it as part of your diet?
Well, traditionally, like if you're around the world, they're eating so many mushrooms as a big part of their diet. They're getting their protein, they're getting their nutrition, vitamins and minerals from mushrooms. So they're stir fried and they put them in, you know, dishes with chicken or whatever, vegetables and in their soups. So they're getting, after I got my acupuncture license, I went to China and I was working in a Chinese traditional hospital for a while over there. And that was a great experience. But in the restaurant that I'd go downstairs for lunch into a little restaurant, and I noticed that almost everybody had mushrooms in their stir fries and in their soups, and woodier and shiitake and quite a enoki and quite a few others. So, you know, that's a substantial part of their diet, but they're also getting the medicine. They're also getting the immune boost. They're getting the anti-inflammatory effects. So they are getting, so they're basically, you know that they're eating these mushrooms, not only for nutrition, but for also for fortifying their health and keeping them from getting sick. But in traditional Chinese medicine, so many mushrooms have also been made into powders and put into capsules and tablets, and also boiled along with other Chinese herbs like astragalus or, you know, Codenopsis, other Chinese herbs. They've been boiled with those and then consumed as teas. So they use them in pretty much all forms that you want to mention. But yes, they do make pills and they make capsules, they make powders. Tinctures, not so much, because remember that the number one most important active ingredient of mushrooms for immune boosting are the beta-glucans, and they have zero solubility in alcohol.
In alcohol, they're more water soluble.
So you're not going to get hardly any of the immune boosting properties of mushrooms if you make a tincture.
Okay.
That's the bottom line there.
Well, that's good.
So
to
you're
know.
Much better off making powders or teas, okay. And especially powders. And I tell exactly how to make the powders step by step, and have pictures in my book how to make the tea powders.
Okay. So if someone's saying, like, okay, you know, I want to get into mushrooms, understanding the nutritional benefit and the medicinal benefit, if you're going to pick just one, which I know none of us want to pick just one, because I actually love the flavor, the different flavor profiles and textures of mushrooms. But if you were looking at it for which mushroom has the most uses, is there one that you're like, okay, if you're only going to start with one, start with this one?
Oh, well, not button mushroom. You know, many people are familiar with button mushrooms, but if you really look at the nutritional value and the medicinal value of button mushrooms, it's pretty low. However, having said that, button mushrooms do have a lot of this anti-aging compound called ergotheanine. So button mushrooms do have a fair amount of that, and you're getting some nutrition out of them if you cook them, especially. So button mushrooms aren't exactly, you know, not to be avoid, or, you know, you don't have to avoid them. On the other hand, shiitake is really the mushroom that I recommend usually as the first one to try for major medicinal benefits, because shiitake, besides all the nutrition that you're getting an incredible amount of prebiotic fiber, which is so important in our diet. We can discuss that later if we get into the microbiome. But shiitake has a really good amount of prebiotic fiber. They have good nutrition, good protein, and they have a really pretty high amount of the immune modulating beta glucans, and they're widely available. Many stores now have shiitake, and they're delicious. They're absolutely delicious, and usually, again, pretty available. So shiitake, I think, is the world's second most popular mushroom after the button mushroom.
Oh, I was just going to say, is the button the most popular? Okay, which would make sense.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that I've been seeing a lot lately is mushroom coffee or mushroom cocoa. You know, like it's made into a powder, added to cocoa powder, maybe dried milk, depending on what varieties, you know, where you're getting it from. For people, it's kind of like one of the newer health trends that's kind of popping all up. So is there a possibility that you could consume too much, or is there, like, I know certain herbs, there's duration of use, and then should a break on some of them? Some it's fine to just take, you know, obviously without stop, just to have as a daily thing. So I guess what I'm asking is there a possibility of consuming too much, and recommended duration of treatment when it comes to using your mushrooms?
No, there's no limit to how much mushrooms you can eat, really. If it's shiitake, if it's button mushrooms, if it's lion's mane, if it's maitake, you know, oyster mushrooms, there's no real limit to how much you can eat. They are truly a food, and you're getting nutrition. Some people, a few people can be allergic to mushrooms. So it's always good to just try a dish with a small amount of mushrooms first. You're not used to eating a particular species. I mean, I've never seen anybody react to shiitake, but yeah, but it's you know, vaguely possible that you might have you just don't do that well with mushrooms. But that's pretty much of a rarity. So because they're food medicine, you really don't have to worry. They're not drugs. They're not drugs. If you take a preparation or if you're eating them for the medicinal benefits, they are food. So it's food medicine, and you really don't have to worry about how much you're eating. I mean, one time I had a friend who grilled up some shiitakes, like maybe quite a few shiitake, like 30, 40 shiitake fruiting bodies on the grill. She put a kind of a light sauce on it, garlic sauce. And then we were sitting out in the patio and we started eating them. And I literally ate, I overate. I mean, I way overate. The next day I was feeling, oh man, I ate a lot of mushrooms. But I literally couldn't stop eating them. They were so delicious. And the texture was so fantastic that I ate 10 fruiting bodies and boy, those are good. And I just couldn't stop eating them. So I probably overall, I might've eaten 15 or 20 fruiting bodies. And I felt a little, a bit in my gut, cause that's a lot of fiber.
Yeah.
But I was okay. I certainly didn't get sick or anything. So okay. No, there's no real limit. If you enjoy them, eat them. But like everything in our diet, we have to have a balanced diet. So you don't want to exclude, just go, oh, I love mushrooms, I'm just going to eat mushrooms. And, so always have a balanced diet. But on the other hand, you can't really overeat mushrooms.
Okay, good. So this kind of leads to my next question. And because obviously mushroom are a fungi, I know most people are familiar with that. So does how and where mushrooms are grown, versus wild versus, in agriculture where people are growing them, does it one affect their efficacy? But second, so for example, if it's like lion's mane around here grows on a lot of our old growth trees. And so right. Would it absorb some of the actual like active compounds from the type of wood that it's growing on?
Yes. I mean, I've been asked that question a lot. Does the mushroom character change the nutrition or the medicine depending on the substrate upon which it's growing, whether a particular tree or if it's grown in blocks in cultivation, whether it's grown on grain or whether it's grown on wood? Yes, it will change to a certain extent. However, remember that the mushrooms are genetically programmed to produce a certain, nutritional compounds and certain like protein, fatty acids, and also what we call secondary compounds, which are the phenolics, the terpenes, small molecular, low molecular weight compounds like terpenes, phenolics, and things like that, alkaloids, even in a few cases. So they're programmed to produce amount, so the substrate, yes, could affect how much they're producing, but not to a major degree. So you'll get some variation in the nutritional quality, and you'll get some depending on whether they're growing in the wild, depending on whether they're growing on say brown rice in a growth facility. Yes, there will be some variation, but it's not going to be massive. It's not going to be a giant change. And will mushrooms pick up toxins? That's another thing. If they're growing in the wild, mushrooms are metal accumulators, so that's why they're really high in trace minerals, zinc, copper, iron, and other minerals, because they are metal accumulators from the environment. So you don't want to pick wild mushrooms next to the road, for instance, or next to a factory. Probably better, good idea not to pick them in those places, because they could pick up, like in the agricultural fields where they use fertilizers, there could be some metals in there that we don't want, heavy metals even. So mushrooms don't, like if you pick mushrooms in a pristine place or in a place away from factories and chemicals and spraying and roads, then you should be fine. I mean, they're not going to produce, they're not going to take up a super amount of lead or cadmium or anything like that. But if they're growing in a toxic environment, yes, you have to be careful about that.
Okay, to know. What mushrooms are the most clinically used mushrooms?
Well, no doubt it's going to be number one, the number one studied in clinical trials and other studies is turkey tail. So turkey tail, Trimedes versicolor, is the number one proven mushroom for its effects in cancer care programs, reducing inflammation, boosting our immune response. It's the number one studied mushroom. And it's been used for a couple thousand years. Number two would be reishi. So number one and number two, people ask me, well, what mushroom should I start with if I'm interested in trying them? And it's always going to be turkey tail and reishi. Those are the two that have the most research behind them, the most clinical trials, and also the highest amount of immune modulating beta glucans. So those are the two that I recommend starting with always, because they provide really the highest amount of benefit.
Okay, I'm very excited because turkey tail actually is supposed to grow in our area. I just have not went out and have foraged for that one yet. So it's on my list to do. And I also very interesting that they're having that there's that many clinical studies that we've actually have available on mushrooms, because I have found it's harder to find clinical studies, especially in the United States, on alternative medicines, especially herbs. They just don't seem to do as many clinical studies on them. So that's exciting to hear that they're being looked at and actually used in studies.
Yeah, there are literally thousands of people in these clinical studies showing, and turkey tail, as I said, is the number one study. But basically, there's a whole body of research on turkey tail, specifically turkey tail mycelium, interestingly, not the fruiting bodies. So turkey tail mycelium, there are all these clinical trials that include thousands of people, and using pretty much the same model. And the model is people that have diagnosed cancers, typically of the GI tract. So it's stomach cancer, bowel cancer, also sometimes breast cancer and other cancers. So the model is that one group, so people are randomized for the trial. One group is getting standard chemotherapy. Then the other group is getting standard chemotherapy plus the mushroom extract and the mushroom turkey tail mycelium extract. There are other species that are used in clinical trials, but turkey tail and also shiitake as well has a lot of clinical trials, but definitely turkey tail is number one. And so what they look at is the side effects of the chemo, like nausea, fatigue, and especially lowered immune response, because as you can probably guess, if you're taking chemotherapy, your immune system is going to take a big hit. That's very toxic. The chemotherapy is very toxic to your immune system. So your white blood cell count is going to drop, and the overall effectiveness of your immune system is going to be impaired. And, you know, so that's why chemotherapy to me has always been rather, hard to figure out, because, you know, while you're killing the fast growing cells, the cancer cells, at the same time, you're reducing the beneficial effects or the power of your immune system to get rid of the cancer. And it makes no sense at all. Yeah. And so now, fortunately, we're really turning a corner with cancer care. We're using more immunotherapy. Practice is starting to use low dose chemotherapy along with, and there are even maybe some doctors are starting to recommend good diet and, you know, exercise and other things like that. So I think we are turning a corner with cancer care, but still there are lots of cancer or chemotherapy centers, so-called centers in the country that are administering chemotherapy. And chemotherapy, I want to mention this, chemotherapy has no basis, has no clinical studies behind it. It has no body of evidence that it's effective. You can imagine, because chemotherapy, if you go into a chemotherapy center, you could lose your hair, you feel nauseous. So there are a lot of placebo triggers that you're getting if you get a treatment like chemotherapy that has a big impact on your body. So how do we know that it's not just the placebo effect and actually the chemotherapy? There are no clinical studies that really show that. If you look on PubMed.gov, the largest medical database in the world, and you type in chemotherapy at clinical trials, you're not going to find any, because they just don't have them. So what I'm saying is that it's not really evidence-based, and it really does tear down your immune system. So it really, at the end of the day, I guess my point is, always use medicinal mushrooms if you are in any kind of a cancer care program, because this is the most proven medicinal benefit of mushrooms, is that it can reduce nausea, it can boost your immune response, and it can boost your energy when you're taking standard cancer care like chemotherapy, radiation, and so forth. And there, again, there are all these clinical trials that show that. And then the five-year, in the best studies, the five-year survival rate in the group that is getting the mushrooms plus the chemotherapy is actually up to 30% higher than if you're just getting the chemotherapy.
Well, so, that's fantastic.
There are great clinical trials. There's a great body of evidence. Again, I detail that in my book.
Yeah, great. Well, one of the things I wanted to circle back, because we kind of touched on it earlier, is where we were going to be talking about the gut microbiome and the mushrooms and some of the different things that they can benefit along that. So I wanted to make sure we came back to that, because we kind of put a pin in it earlier. And so I wanted to give us some time to talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I like talking about almost more than any other aspect of medicinal mushrooms, or just the health benefits of mushrooms, because I really feel that the prebiotic fiber content of mushrooms is the largest benefit of all of adding more mushrooms to our diet. First of all, right now, there's so much emerging research on our microbiome and the benefits that we receive from having a diverse microbiome and having a microbiome that is really contains a high level of the most beneficial species. As if you've been paying attention at all to the new research on our microbiome and its importance in our health, you likely know, and it has been in the news quite a bit the last year or two, you probably know, or you may have read, that our microbiome, the gut microflora, produce about 70 or 80% of our serotonin. Mm-hmm. So that's mind-boggling in itself. Our body doesn't produce our most important neurotransmitter, or certainly all of them are important, but serotonin is among the most important. It regulates our blood flow in our body, regulates our sexuality, regulates our sleep, regulates our mood. I mean, serotonin is such an important neurotransmitter, and it turns out it's our gut microflora that's producing 80% of our neurotransmitter. That is mind-boggling. And there's this brain gut superhighway called the vagus nerve, and that is being basically so a lot of brain functions, including mood, cognition, and all that, is really highly influenced by the diversity and just the species mix in our microflora and our gut microflora. So this is what we've learned over the last, now that we're able to use DNA technology to really discover how diverse our microflora is. There are, you know, literally hundreds and hundreds of different species in there. And it really matters which species are the highest in there. And it really matters how diverse our microflora is. If we're on a diet, for instance, we're using antibiotics, that really dumbs down our microflora and disorders it. So always use prebiotics and probiotics along with the antibiotics when you're using them. Use them away from the time that you take the antibiotic, like hopefully at least 4 or 5 hours away from when you actually take the tetracycline or whatever it is. But always take your prebiotics and probiotics when you're using antibiotics. So antibiotics can dumb down our microflora, and it also can change the mix so that less beneficial species are going to be proliferating more. And if we have a high meat diet, if we have a diet high in refined food and refined sugar, that also is going to completely disorder our microflora and lead to very unfortunate health outcomes. So what we also know is what blows my mind is that after all of this knowledge that we have now about the importance of fiber in our diet, I mean, it's been advertised. There are fiber supplements out there. The government recommends taking fiber every day. And still, the average amount of fiber that we get in our country and also in Europe is 15 grams a day of high-quality prebiotic fiber. The government recommends 25 grams a day. So we're not even getting what our conservative government that's influenced by big food. Of course, big food the food corporations don't want us to eat a lot of high fiber food, because that would mean whole food. That would mean buying the majority of our diet from the produce section and not the shelves in packages. So they aren't really invested in recommending more fiber, but it just blows my mind. The average person getting 15 grams of fiber, government recommends 25. And if you're on a traditional diet, then you're going to be getting 40 to 60 grams of high quality prebiotic fiber per day. So that shows you how far behind we are on the amount of fiber that we get. And then it just turns out that prebiotic fiber is the single most important change that we can make in our diet. If people ask me all the time, I'm a practitioner and I'm seeing patients, what's the most important thing? They've got all these things going on, chronic inflammation and all the different chronic ailments and symptoms that might arise out of chronic inflammation in our body. What can I do? What's the most important thing I can do? And it's always going to be the number two things that we can always do. Number one, add more fiber to your diet, a lot more fiber. And everything else will take care of itself just if you increase the fiber. Because more fiber means less ultra-processed food. It means less meat. Remember that animal products have zero fiber, folks, zero fiber. There's no fiber in animal products. So eggs, dairy, meat, no fiber. That's why we're seeing all this research now, that says that a plant-based diet is going to really promote longevity and promote health. It's going to lead to a life curve that where you're healthy, 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 bang. You know, that's the end of our body wears out, instead of a curve like this, where we're just, you know, declining our entire life. We don't want that. We want vigor and strength and vitality and excitement. We want that our whole life. And so we want this curve like this. And just by adding more fiber to our diet, it's going to cut our risk of chronic diseases and symptoms associated with chronic inflammation by 50%. If you just raise the fiber that you're getting in the high quality prebiotic fiber, if you just raise it by 15 or 20 grams per day, literally you're going to cut those risk of those chronic diseases and symptoms in half. It's just mind-boggling that we, you know, those statistics don't lie, but it's just so mind-boggling. Okay, now what is a high-quality prebiotic fiber? Excuse me, it's a polymer. It's a plant polymer or mushroom polymer. In other words, long chain of fiber that our body can actually work with and get down in their gut and feed our microflora. They need these polymers to ferment. It's like a cow eating grass, you know, or or a deer eating browsing leaves and green things, or our ancestors digging roots and eating fruit and eating grains and eating greens and so forth. That was their diet. That was our diet. That was, when you think of our lineages going back, our diet was not packaged food from Safeway. It just, we didn't have that. We had to dig our roots. We had to eat the fruits. We had to eat grain. We had to eat greens so we could eat safely. And that was our diet. That was 100% of our diet. And they were getting probably 60 grams of fiber per day. Because, you know, of course, if they could get meat, if they could get eggs, they would eat that. That's a high energy food because fat is such a high energy food. And then they're getting the protein. So fine. But how hard was it to chase down a deer or an antelope or even a woolly mammoth? I mean, that's not so easy, you know. So they did have meat and animal products in their diet, but it was a small amount. And nowadays we have all that. We have refined food. We have, and the food processors have made fat, salt, and sugar. We have a natural desire to eat fat, salt, and sugar because those are high value foods that we could not get easily from our prehistoric diet. We couldn't get those. So we have a desire to seek those out. And now the manufacturers have just packed salt, fat, and sugar into everything on the shelves. And we can't help ourselves. We're eating salt, fat, and sugar. And that's why, and neglecting the, of course, we still eat a lot of greens, hopefully, and vegetables, but there's just, we're eating this way too much, obviously, processed foods, packaged foods, and animal products. And that's why the average person is getting 15 grams of prebiotic fiber per day. But prebiotic fiber is a type of fiber that's feeding our microflora, encourage them to grow and diversify, giving us optimum health. So they're not digested in the upper gut. They're not broken down in the stomach. And like if you cook if you take oatmeal, everybody knows that oatmeal is a good fiber source. If you take oatmeal, buy, say, oat flakes, that's already been cooked. All oats on the market have been cooked or steam cooked just to kind of sterilize them, I guess. But if you take oats or oat flakes and you pour in the form of muesli, and muesli is basically raw oat flakes, chopped nuts, and fruit. So if you eat muesli and you put like oat milk on there, or you put whatever kind of liquid you want on there, and even add some bananas or fresh fruit, and then you eat that, that oat flake is not going to be as broken down as if you cook a mushy pot of oatmeal. You know how we usually put the oats in there and then we cook it until it's all gooey. Well, that's been all broken down into sugar and through the heat, and so almost none of it gets absorbed from the upper gut, and almost none of it gets down to our microflora. So muesli is the health food of Europe, of the Swiss and so forth, and it's basically raw oats soaked until it's tender, until it's soft, along with chopped nuts, fruit, and banana, whatever, and a little milky substance on there, and you just eat that, and it's perfectly delicious. You can warm it up in the microwave if you wanted to, so it's perfectly delicious and digestible, but you're going to get a lot more of that prebiotic fiber. And of course, all vegetables, root crops, yams, sweet potatoes, all of those are high fiber foods. Now, what are the two top prebiotic fiber foods on the planet? The number two prebiotic foods on the planet, number one, mushrooms. Mushrooms literally are the highest prebiotic fiber food on the planet, and that's why they're so valuable. We cannot digest those beta-glucans and chitin. We can't digest those in the upper gut. They all make it down to our lower gut, and then the microflora start fermenting those and proliferating and becoming healthier. And so that's why the addition of mushrooms is so important to our diet. Any kind of mushrooms, they all have these types of fibers. And number two, can you guess what it is? What's the number two top, most important fiber source on the planet in our diet? Anybody guess out there?
I'm going to say like green brassica vegetables, but I might be wrong.
Legumes.
Okay.
Legumes are number two. They have the second highest amount of prebiotic fiber. And so that's why I have an Instant Pot. That's why I eat legume, because I eat very little meat. I mean, I might have sardines once or twice a week because it's sustainable. It's not full of mercury. So I eat sardines once in a great while. I might have salmon out in a restaurant or something. So I'm not totally against it. I have eggs once in a while, maybe once or twice a week.
I'm a grass-fed, grass-finished farmer using regenerative practices, Dr. Hobbs, just so you know. So I would argue a lot on what I see in our diet in the studies is meat that is raised on grains, because that is not how ruminant animals are meant to flourish.
Right. Grass-fed, of course, is going to be absolutely the best. I'm not saying don't eat meat. I'm not saying that. I'm saying balance it with a lot of prebiotic fiber in your diet. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I'm not saying don't eat meat, don't eat animal products. I just happen to be mostly a vegetarian.
Yeah.
But I eat my point being is I eat beans every single day because
I actually wanted to ask you a question on the beans, because with the legumes, I know a lot of people, especially with, like with dried beans. So like we raise black beans, I raise kidney beans, pinto beans. Like we raise a lot of our own beans, but
delicious.
They're very good. But I know a lot of people, I think when they're introducing a lot more fiber as well, but with beans too, and some of that is the preparation of, you know, soaking and then pouring that water off, because after they've soaked, there's a lot more starch in that water, et cetera, and then cooking them. But a lot of people do get flatulence or digestive upset when they do eat, you know, dried beans or foods with a lot of fiber. So could you kind of talk to that a little bit, like maybe tips to help reduce that? Or is that just something that's your gut microbiome adjusting and that will ease with time?
Absolutely, it will. Well, the way to take care of that, and I'll admit that if I eat black beans or if I eat pinto beans that's why they refry beans in Mexican cuisine, because that gets rid of the flatulence. But if I eat black beans out in a restaurant or something, more often than not, I'll get a lot of gas because they don't cook them enough, or they don't soak them. They don't take the time to soak them, as you were saying. But there is a way, and soaking them overnight is fine, and pouring the water off, but you're not going to get rid of the flatulent causing compounds by just soaking and pouring it off. These are called trisaccharides, raffinose. So these are types of small molecules that we cannot, ferment in the upper gut, and it gets down there, and it just so happens that the microflora can really metabolize those very quickly, and it produces a lot of methane, a lot of gas. So how do you get rid of those? By cooking them well, soak them overnight to soften them, and then cook them well. That's one. But the very, very best way, and this is the only way I cook legumes, and I get zero gas. And believe me, if I ate most people's black beans out there, I would get lots of gas, no doubt about it. My partner is going to be complaining for sure, but now we know how to do it, and that's basically you get a pressure cooker, you get an Instant Pot or whatever.
I love my Instant Pot. Yeah.
So you go ahead and you put your legumes in there. I usually use two. If I make dal or if I make lentil soup, I'm going to put a cup and a half of it in there. Then I'm going to fill it up about 2/3 of the way of water. Turn the Instant Pot or the pressure cooker on high pressure, and then turn the keep warm function off, and go ahead and set it up. Most, if you look at your Instant Pot guide, usually lentils or kidney beans are the larger beans, need about 30 to 40 minutes, but lentils need only about 20 minutes to 25 minutes. And you set the time, push it, turn it on. And what the pressure is, so what you're creating an environment in that pressure cooker that is very special. It's called subcritical water extraction. So you're going to increase, how if you boil legumes, you can only get to 212 degrees. In fact, a little bit less because the extra heat is coming off of steam. But what happens if you contain the steam in the pot? The temperature is going to go up higher, and you're going to break all of those gas promoting trisaccharides. You're going to break them all down. So when you pressure cook your legumes, you're going to get zero gas. And that's what I found over the, I've been using it for many years. And I used to, I love legumes, but I'd always have trouble with lots and lots of gas until I started pressure cooking it.
Right. Well, I do love, I like my pressure cooker for cooking, and I'm also a pressure canner. So I love the things that the pressure options give us. So this has been fascinating. I know there's so much more that we can't cover in just one episode here. So your book, Medicinal Mushrooms, The Essential Guide, we'll have in our blog post and show notes when this gets posted. But where else can people find you, follow along with what you're doing, and learn more about the medicinal mushrooms?
Yes, thank you. You can go to my website, ChristopherHobbs.com, which has lots of free handouts, videos, and other resources on there. You can see my Instagram posts on Christopher Hobbs One. Follow me on Instagram. I post a lot of reels on there. YouTube channel, Green Adventures. So those are my, and then also Facebook. You can follow me on my professional Facebook, Christopher Hobbs, Dr. Christopher Hobbs. And so those are my social media. I do post. I have free handouts and so forth. I have other books. I have notices of classes because I do webinars. I do lots of webinars on the Shift Network and other networks. And I have my own channel on my website that I do webinars, three-part webinars and so forth. But I just want to say in parting that, we talked a lot about the health benefits of mushrooms, and I think this is most important. But remember that, again, the turkey tail and reishi, lion's mane, those are and chagas are really important, but those are probably the three most popular ones right now. Mm-hmm. And remember that they can help control chronic inflammation in our body, which can get rid of a lot of symptoms like achy muscles or rheumatism, arthritis. It can also help boost our immune response, keep us strong during the cold and flu season. So the regular use of these mushrooms and some other species are really a good thing to do, not only for all the prebiotic and nutrition, but for the medicinal effects. We didn't talk as much about those, but those are the most beneficial species, and they can be taken as powders or supplements.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much. We'll make sure and have links to all of those things so people can go and learn. And thank you for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me. Much pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed today's interview as much as I did. And you can go to the blog post, which is at melissaknorris.com/422, just the number 422, because it's episode 422, to see any links, show notes, etc. And if you are curious about how to grow your own mushrooms at home, as well as forage wild mushrooms, I am doing a special live class with a good friend of mine, Chris Gilmore. Funnily enough, they're both named Chris, and talking about mushrooms. So we will have the link for you. If you're watching the podcast episode on YouTube, we'll put it beneath the video in the video description. If you're listening to this the old-fashioned way, then at the blog post, melissaknorris.com/422, we will have a link where you can register and come to the class totally free and learn more about raising them yourself so that you don't have to buy them, and foraging those as well. And that live class, you can register now, and it will be held on Wednesday, March 20th of 2024. So I look forward to having you join me in that class. And I'll be back here with you next week for our next episode. Blessings and mason jars for now, my friends.